The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Moshe Brisky presents his lecture, What's on Your Bucket List?
One of the finest and most celebrated classical musicians of modern times is a violinist by the name of Joshua Bell. At the age of 17, Bell made his debut at Carnegie Hall. And since then, he's performed with world's greatest symphony orchestras and conductors. His concerts are always sold out. People are willing to spend huge dollars to see him play live. And when he finishes, he gets standing ovation after standing ovation with requests for more and more encores. His violin that he has is a famous Stradivarius crafted in 1713, which is a whole new story on its own. He paid $3.5 million for it. When Bell plays this violin, it's mastery at work. 16 years ago, a journalist with the Washington Post, his name is Gene Weingarten, conducted an interesting social experiment. And he approached Josh Bell with his idea, and to his delight, Bell was up to it. This is what they did. Friday, January 12, 2007. This happened to be 2 days after Joshua Bell accepted the Avery Fisher Prize, the greatest honor a classical musician in America can receive. January 12, 2007, he shows up at 7:51 a.m. in the mall of the Washington, D.C. Metro station. He wasn't dressed in a tuxedo. He wore jeans and a t-shirt and a Washington Nationals baseball cap and pretended to be one of these lowly street performers, you know, standing in the train station. Took out a little stool, opened up his violin case, put some quarters in the case, took out his $3.5 million violin, and began to play. Now, the pieces that he chose to play at this experiment were not your ordinary tunes. They were some of the most complex, breathtaking musical masterpieces that have been around for centuries. So he played what he would play in the world-famous opera houses. And he put his heart and soul into the music as if he was performing at the Vienna State Opera House itself, producing the most elegant and pristine notes from his magnificent instrument. He played 6 different pieces over the course of 43 minutes during rush hour as people are making their way into the metro station. You could watch this entire clip on YouTube, the full 43 minutes of it. Gene Weingarten, who was behind this experiment, wrote an article based on it, and here are the facts. During those 43 minutes, 1,097 people passed by. Okay? 43 minutes, 1,097 are walking by. 7 stopped to hear the music. 7 out of 1,097. 27 people tossed a few coins while rushing past. The rest were totally oblivious to the fact that there in the subway station is one of the world's greatest violin players playing on one of the most expensive violins, playing the most complex tunes. It meant nothing to them. Some you can see as they're walking by is looking at Bell as a nuisance as to what is this guy doing here. When the story appeared in the Washington Post, it generated a huge response. Many people commented how the article made them want to cry because they realized perhaps what this exercise was all about. that we can't stop even for a moment to appreciate things that are around us. If you were to ask any of those 1,097, or I should say 1,090, because seven did stop. So if we went to the 1,090 people and we asked them, why were you passing by that day? Where were you rushing to? Simple question. I'm sure we would get good answers. Some would say they were on their way to school. Some would say they're on their way to work. Maybe some were going to a doctor's appointment. Maybe some were going to do some shopping. Maybe some were going to the gym. They would all have an answer to that very easy question. Where were you rushing to? But what if after they gave us their initial answer, we would say back to them, and why were you going there? So level two of the question, why? Again, they would get a little annoyed by the questions now, but they would say, I'm going to school to get a degree. I'm going to work to earn a living. I'm going shopping to buy myself some things. I'm going to the gym to be in good shape. And then we were to say, but why? Why do you have to be healthy? Why do you need that degree? Why do you need to earn a living? If we continue to ask the question, then they would say, so I can live, so I can eat, so I can present myself properly. And then you did the same thing again. But why? You see, the big why question is, everything that we do in life just a preparation for something else? Well, as one person put it, sometimes life seems to be like one big laundromat. We bring in clothes, toss them in water, add some detergent, bleach it, put in a few coins, throw it in the dryer, take them out, fold them, wear them. A week later, we're back at the laundromat again. Is life just like a laundromat? On the sixth day of creation, God said, let us make man. You've heard this question many times. Who is the us in let us make man? There's only one God. Who's the us? And every commentary has something to say on it. I present to you one of the commentaries, that the us is you and me, human beings, that God endowed with the freedom of choice to be his partner in this creation of a world. That the fulfillment of the creation of the world is going to be an us mission, God and the human being with free choice. That God is invested in us. He invested within each and every single one of our souls a potential to develop this world. And as long as we're drawing breath on this earth, we all have a purpose to fulfill and an impact to make. Every moment of life is a precious gift. And yet, it appears as if days can come and days can go with little or no consequence. And many days can just be written off completely as if nothing really happened that day. Rav Avram Palm of blessed memory was the headmaster of a very prominent yeshiva in Brooklyn called Torah Vadas. Now, once an elderly man in Rav Palm's community took ill and had to be hospitalized. Rav Tom took out a piece of paper, he wrote this man a letter of encouragement and inspiration, his blessings for a speedy recovery, and he sent the letter off. The man in the hospital was so thrilled to receive this letter, such attention from such a special man, such a busy man, and he took the time to write to me, such wisdom from such an illustrious spiritual leader. It lifted his spirits tremendously. He kept the letter right by his bedside, and anyone that came to visit him in the hospital, he made them read Rav Palm's letter. Look, Rav Palm sent me a letter. Whoever came in, look, the Rosh Hashiva sent me a letter. Look what the Rosh Hashiva said. Several months later, the elderly man's condition took a turn for the worse, and unfortunately, he passed away. And at the funeral, his family members all made mention that the last few months, he had so much excitement because he received this letter from Rav Palm, and they actually read the letter at the funeral because it was so important to their deceased loved one. Later that week, Rav Palm was told about the funeral and his letter and what his letter meant to him, and that he showed the letter to everyone and he kept it at his bedside. And the surprising reaction of Rav Palm was, "This is very frightening to me. What you're telling me really concerns me." It took me 5 minutes to write that letter, and yet it gave the recipient such comfort, and it gave the family such comfort that they chose to read it at the funeral. Look how much good I was able to accomplish in a mere 5 minutes. What frightens me is that the Almighty can hold this letter and say to me, "Look at the wonderful thing you did in 5 minutes. What about all the other 5 minute spans of time that you could have brought such spirit to other people? What did you do with those? How many people did you not send a letter to that you could have lifted their spirits like you did this individual?" That's the way he took it. Think about it. How much time and energy does it take to do something sensitive and thoughtful that can have a great and lasting impact for another person? Whether it's sitting down and writing a get well card, or shooting off an email to someone, or picking up a phone. That human contact that we have with others means so much to them and takes such little effort on our part. A wise person once said, "The best thing in life are not things." What are the best things in life? Family and friendship and faith and gratitude and wisdom and knowledge and character and love and kindness and courage. Those are the essential ingredients for a meaningful life and a happy life. They say that Sam Walton, who was the billionaire CEO of Walmart, one of the largest corporations in America, he basically put his entire life into his business. And in that arena, he succeeded beyond anyone's wildest dreams. But it came at a price, because he hardly spent any time with his family, hardly spent time with his wife, with his children, with his grandchildren. He didn't allow these moments of interaction, of connection, of celebration with his loved ones because he was needed at the business. It was all business all the time. And they say that Walton, on his deathbed, struggled to get out his last words. And when he finally said it, they were the words, "I blew it." Looking back at life with all the billions of dollars, "I blew it. I blew life." The sages say, "Domav einam oizrim, yomav einam choizrim." Life is short, and certain things in life stay on with us forever, but as Sam Walton figured out a little too late, our money is not one of them. The comedian Stephen Wright once said, "I intend to live forever." And you know what? So far, so good. The reality is no one lives forever. Not even Rondy Dangerfield, who once said, "My luck is so bad that if I bought a cemetery, people would stop dying." I guess he never bought a cemetery because people are still dying. One more, they say that such nice things about people at their funerals that it makes me so sad that I'm going to miss mine by just a day or two. You see, we make jokes about death. And that's the way we sometimes react to things that we're afraid of. Jews were afraid of the Tsar, so they made jokes about the Tsar. Jews are always afraid about high cholesterol, so we make a lot of jokes about food. But many of us are afraid of death, and some are even terrified of it. I think more than anything else, death scares us because we cannot wrap our heads around the notion of being in a state of non-existence. The idea that we're going to disappear, that we will not have awareness, that we will no longer matter, as we spoke about it in another class, that we'll be gone. The only trace of us will be confined to the memories of those still amongst the living, but we will become nothing. And that's frightening. So let's share the Jewish perspective. There's a beautiful parable in the Medrash. The Medrash tells us to imagine. So let's imagine together with the Medrash. There are a pair of twins resting comfortably in their mother's womb. Their mouths are closed. They are being fed through tubes entering their navels without having to exert any effort on their own. All taken care of. They're being kept warm in the fluids of the embryonic sac, which is their entire world. Everything is so wonderful and peaceful in that sheltered environment, and they can't envision the possibility of a different way of life. This is existence. Now imagine these twins are suddenly given the gift of consciousness, and they're able to think and communicate out loud with each other. They realize that things are starting to change in here. Slowly but surely, they feel themselves turning and slipping lower and lower. So they begin to wonder, what's the future have in store for them? The two brothers happen to have different personalities. One is an optimist, a believer by nature. The other is a pessimist, a skeptic by nature. And the brothers inside their mother's womb get into a debate. The believer says, I am sure there's a whole new life waiting for us after we depart our present home. He says to his brother, it doesn't make sense that God would have put us here for 9 months, cared for us, fed us, allowed us to grow and develop, only for it to suddenly come to an end without any purpose. There must be a greater plan that we just don't see right now. I'm sure that these 9 months are all just setting the stage for a much more meaningful life to follow. There's no way that all we have to look forward to is oblivion. His brother, on the other hand, is much more practical and realistic. So he says to his optimistic twin, there you go again, confusing your hopes with reality. Look around you. Can't you see? Everything that allows us to live, the womb, the sac, the umbilical cord, it's all right here. This is existence. Once we get popped out of this place, it's sayonara. It's over, baby. There's nothing else out there. The believing brother doesn't get discouraged. He explains patiently that no, once they leave their mother's womb, they will become independent. We'll figure out a way to get food out there in outer space. We'll figure out how to get our nourishment. We'll have some ability to move around more freely. In fact, eventually we'll be able to think and to walk and to talk and to study and to build things for ourselves. And his brother mocks him, asking him to provide further details on these fantasies. You've been watching too much Netflix at night. Where are you getting this fantasy from? And so the debate continues for weeks until one day it happens. The water inside the womb bursts. There's a great deal of pushing and pounding. The twins realize they're being forced out. And the believer is the first to go. His brother is still inside. He's listening closely for any hint as to what might be happening. And he hears his brother give a loud scream. And he says, you see, I was right all along. I just heard my poor brother scream in terror. It's the scream of death. It's the end of life, and my end is next. Of course, what the pessimistic twin does not hear are the joyful shouts of Mazel Tov, on the other hand, of the mother and father excitedly congratulating each other on the birth of their first child, who made his grand entrance into this world with a scream not of death, but a scream of life. It's a beautiful parable in the Medrash. You see, what appears from the limited perspective to be the end of life is actually the beginning of a higher form of existence. So too says the Medrash, death is not the end of life. Follow the optimistic twin in the womb, what the optimistic womb was saying. All of this existence is not to turn into nothing. There's a transition to another place, to another world. Everything we experience upon death is a transition whereby our souls are granted the freedom to soar above the physical limitations of our bodies. This sac, known as Earth, that's the world we live in now. And we're able to achieve a blissful spiritual experience here, but there is a world above it. Now we will enter after our experience here on this world. So if everything about our lives is defined by our bodies, if in this existence all we focus on is our material desires, our material wants by our bodies, and our struggle for physical existence is all we focus on, we're rushing in the morning because we have to get to school, we have to get to a job, we have to get to here, it's all about us. If all we do is spend our days running from one place to another, from school to the office, from gym to the doctor, from supermarket to the mall, and we're consumed exclusively in this world, in this life, in this existence with our physical needs, then it becomes very difficult to imagine any existence beyond the physical. Because that's all we know. It's all about the body. And so when the body decomposes and reverts to dust, game over. And so we're afraid. Someone once approached Rabbi Abraham Twersky and asked this very simple question. The question was, how do you know you have a soul? It's a good question. I want you to hear the answer. Again, question, how do you know you have a neshama? How do you know you have a soul? And he answered, I don't have a soul. I am a soul. I have a body. My soul is who I am. I am my essence. That's my soul. My soul was given a body. The body is housing the soul for this duration of existence. But at some point after 120 years, when the body comes to an end, the soul does not. I am a soul. I live on. And if we understand that our souls are a gift that God Himself breathed into us, as Genesis explains to us, then it's coming from the divine essence, and that by a very identity of something coming from the divine is eternal. Souls don't die. Yes, of course we believe in an afterlife, an olam haba, a world to come. And we'll know a lot more about it once we get there, and we're in no rush to get there. But for now, the practical relevance of the afterlife to our current state is simply to us to make sure that our actions in this life are taken with a sense of eternal ramifications. In simple English, the message is, make it count. Make every precious day on this earth count. Make sure you leave an impact that will outlive you, that will outlast your physical presence on this earth. The real tragedy of death is that it represents the closing of the curtain of our ability to do good deeds. At that point, we no longer have free will to do good or the opposite. It's only what we bring to that moment that will count. So these moments are critical. So in this last talk that I'm giving at this retreat, I'd like to propose something. Not in a morbid or depressing way, but rather in a galvanizing, invigorating way. Over the last 20 to 25 years or so, there's been this phenomenon out there called bucket list, whereby people create a wish list of things they would like to do during the limited time they have left on this earth. Or to put it more crassly, how it got the name, before they kick the bucket. That's where the name came from. I don't particularly care for the term bucket list. I think the concept, however, is an intriguing one. So what I would like to propose is that we all sit down and compile our own bucket list. But let's not call it a bucket list. Let's change the name and call it a life list. Let's not focus on the death aspect, kicking the bucket, but life. These are the things I want to accomplish in life while very much alive. You know, there are websites out there today where people post their life goals, and it's interesting to see things that are on people's lists, like, I want to swim with the dolphins, I want to build an igloo, I want to hike the Appalachian Trail. One that I kind of gave some thought to, I want to visit every Major League Baseball stadium in the world. I could get that one. But put the exotic stuff aside, unless it's really part of you. Sometime in the next few days, take out one of those notepads or open up a Word file on your computer. Call it My Life List. And it may not be easy at first, but you'll get used to it. Start with just writing down what I would call every narishkeit that comes to mind. Anything that comes to your mind that you would like to do in your lifetime. Just write it. You're going to do a lot of editing of this list, so don't think too much when you first start. Just start putting things down. You want to learn a new language, write it down. Pick the language you want, write it down. You want to learn how to play a harmonica, put it down. You want to climb the Lincoln Memorial late at night in the rain barefoot for whatever strange reason, just go ahead, put it down. You want to sing karaoke on the top of your lungs, put it down, whatever it may be. And then a few days later, come back to it when you're a little more calm. Start deleting some of the crazy ones, perhaps, and start filling it with some that perhaps have more meaning. Because in addition to listing goals that are interesting, that are exciting, that are adventurous, which we all have, and we should have it on that list, make a majority of your goals and aspirations meaningful ones. I'm going to throw out suggestions, but in every room, these suggestions mean something for some and nothing for another, so bear with me. Establish a weekly ritual that, come what may, every Friday you call your parents before Shabbos and wish them a Shabbat Shalom. You can call, you can text, you can email, or you can see them, but that wherever you are in the world and as busy as you are, you call them. Now, some of you don't have your parents. I say call them anyway. Every Friday, speak to your parents, whether in their heavenly world or in this world. They're part of your existence. They will always be part of your existence. They're always watching over you. Talk to them. Women may want to do this when they're lighting the candles, to talk to their parents that are in the heavenly world. You may want to do it an hour before Shabbat. But establish it as a ritual. This is just a suggestion that I'm putting out there. Plan that family trip to Israel. If you're not one that has visited Israel ever, put it on that list. If you have visited, put it on again. But it shouldn't just be for the famed tourist attractions, climbing Masada and swimming in the Dead Sea, but really feel the rich history. Allow Israel to talk to your neshama, to your soul. It should be a spiritual trip to Israel, or a biblical study group tour to Israel, where you're studying the texts of the Torah, where it takes place, so that Torah, Israel, and yourself all bond together. Have you in your lifetime actually gone through the five books of Moses? I'm not talking about just reading it through, but reading it through with commentary. Even just once, from the very beginning of Genesis to the very end of Deuteronomy. Every one of us should make it a business in our lifetime that we have gone through the five books of Moses. You've already accomplished that. Have you done the books of the prophets? Have you taken the time just at least one time to go through it? I know you're familiar with some of the names, Isaiah and Ezekiel and Daniel. Have you studied their stories inside their text? Depending where you are in observance today, you can either join the monthly shul club. That's for those that don't go to synagogue at all during the year. Try going once a month. You could join the weekly shul club. That's for those that go once a month, to switch it to once a week. You could join the daily minyan club, or the three time a day. Wherever you're holding, increase it, making synagogue more a part and parcel of your life. For those that do not keep all the Jewish holidays regularly, one year, you pick that, designate that year, and in that one year, you will celebrate every Jewish holiday. Not one day Rosh Hashanah, you're going to do the 2 day Rosh Hashanah. You're going to follow all the rules and traditions. You're going to learn about each holiday, and you're going to do it. You're going to build that sukkah, you're going to get that lulav and esrog. One time in your life, experience all the holidays in that one given year. Now, if you love it really much and you want to do it the second year, that doesn't violate your bucket list. You're allowed to. And we can go on with this list. If you don't light Shabbat candles every Friday, one full year you're going to light Shabbat candles, or you're going to light Shabbat candles for the rest of your life. You already light Shabbat candles? I'll throw out another challenge to you. In a given year that you will find 25 women that haven't lit Shabbos candles to light them. And keep a little chart, 1, 2, 3. For the men, the same thing. If you don't put on tefillin, consider starting to put on tefillin. If you do put on tefillin, pick a number. In a given year, in a 12-month period, a Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah, you're taking upon yourself to put on tefillin with X amount of people during that year. Put it on your life list. I have another thought. Mentor someone. Adopt one person to mentor, to help guide them through the challenges of finding a career, finding their ways. It's a tough world out there for someone first entering the job market, and they don't know what careers they should go into, and they could use your experience, your help, perhaps your connections to get an interview. Make a difference in another human being's life by saying, I'm going to see to it that you find a career, that you're good at this career, that you're happy at this career. And if things go sour in the middle, call me, because I'm not giving up on you. You're in my life list. I will see this through. How many of you have ever made a shidduch, ever made a match? A lot of hands didn't go up. One shidduch in your lifetime. Again, if you could take on more, take on more. But the idea that you have a friend that's single and lonely and can use your help, pick up a phone, make some calls, find some websites, find some organizations, find the way to get them married, of course, Jewishly. Make a Jewish shidduch, at least one in your lifetime. Others can pick setting up time to visit lonely seniors. You have senior homes in your community. You have hospitals in your community. Give of yourself some time, whether it's once a week, once a month. These are things that are suggestions. And while I hope some of these might resonate with you, I realize that formulating a life list is by no means a one-size-all proposition. You need to do some work. You need to think it through. Find your passions. Find your distinct goals, your individual mission statements. I urge you to be creative, to be imaginative, to be optimistic, but stay realistic. The fantasies that you put in there that have a very small chance, that lessens the entire focus of what we're doing. We're trying to make it something realistic that you could reach. Real goals that you can actually try to pursue and, God willing, achieve, hopefully sooner than later. And if you do them all right away in the first 5 years, do it again. Make another list. Make sure to include goals that are likely to be of lasting and enduring value, because chances are it won't be the stuff about acquiring, the things that you want to own, the car you want to one day buy, and it won't be the adventures you enjoy, the vacations and the cruises you want to take, which could be part of the list, but my guess is when all said and done, it will be the acts of goodness and kindness and meaning and purpose and spirituality that you perform that will ultimately introduce those real answers into your life as to what we started with, why, the why of life. The story is told of two close friends who, as the years passed, decided that they wanted to do something to leave their marks, to leave a lasting impression of themselves in this world after they moved on to the next. And so they each decided to do something significant to perpetuate their memories that way. The first man, he was the more affluent of the two, had this huge, magnificent pillar of rear marble cut from a quarry at a cost of millions of dollars. He then had his name engraved in big, bold, gold leaf letters upon the pillar, placed it upon a mountaintop so all can see forever and ever his name. An impressive, albeit pointless, monument to a man and his wealth. The second individual, not as wealthy, chose a very different way of being remembered. He dug up a wellspring near a desert thoroughfare. He planted shady fruit trees and installed benches all around the flowing springs of refreshing mineral water. Over time, that spot became a beautiful and popular oasis where the travelers from near and far would stop to quench their thirst and enjoy the sweet fruit and rest their weary limbs and cool in the shade. For generations, people continued to benefit from the foresight of this wise and benevolent man. The Talmud tells us that we don't build monuments for the virtuous, for their deeds are true memorial. As I said, all of us should, and God willing, we're all going to live long, happy, and healthy years till 120. But as practical and thinking human beings and conscientious Jews, it is nonetheless perfectly appropriate to give thought to how we would want to be remembered many years from now. What sort of legacies do we wish to leave behind for future generations? You see, our legacies are not shaped by what we might one day become. They're shaped by what we do right now. I heard a beautiful saying that our lives are not measured in years, they're measured in the lives of people we touch around us. There's a man in my community, his name is Martin Teitelbaum. Martin is a very skilled and successful developer, contractor. He's built some major projects throughout Southern California. And he was also the contractor who headed up the construction of the Chabad Center for Jewish Life, which he completed in the year 2011. And he invested a great deal of time and energy into this project. At a recent event where we celebrated the mortgage burning ceremony of that particular building, Marty got up and he spoke. And he said, building the Center for Jewish Life was not among the biggest projects I've ever done. In fact, it was the smallest, but it was the largest. What did he mean? He meant that among the many things about his life which he's proud, spearheading the construction of an edifice like this will always loom largest. Moreover, having dedicated the building in the memory of his father, he knows that he gave his father and by extension his entire family this gift of eternity. Because all the good that will be done over the years in that facility is in memory of his dad. This perspective doesn't only belong to folks like general contractors and people that can dedicate buildings. It's the builders of goodness that create legacies. And that's there for each and every single one of us. So perhaps another thing to add to your life list is to make some sort of Jewish legacy plan. So when you work with your estate planner, to think about the enormous good you can do by including a bequest to a cause you really believe in. And I would urge it to be a Jewish cause of education for children, for a community, so that even after our existence in this world, we're still going to be making a difference. Which is why this is not a conversation about death, but it's really about life. It's about our love for life and how we as Jews cherish and appreciate life as a gift much bigger than ourselves in the here and now. In fact, we're taught that when you think about matters of one's life, post-life, it's a segula, it's a blessing for long life in the physical world. Benny Friedman at the concert Thursday night sang a song called The Man from Vilna. If you didn't follow the storyline, I want to share that story with you. It's a very powerful story. There was a man by the name of Rabbi Leo Goldman. He was on a flight from Chicago to Detroit. And he notices this fellow passenger, an elderly Jew, struggling putting his carry-on bag on the compartment above. So naturally, the rabbi jumps up and helps the man with the bag to put it up. And he starts a conversation. As it turns out, the elderly man was on his way home after having attended a wedding in Chicago. So with all due respect, the rabbi asks him, I can see that you're an elderly man and it's not easy for you to travel. If this was a grandchild of yours, I get it. But you told me it's just a cousin. I'm sure if you would have sent back the return card that you can't make it because you don't live in the state, they would have understood. And the man says, oh, no, 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 no. Rolls up his sleeve, shows him his concentration camp numbers. And he says, ever since I survived the concentration camp, I have never missed an opportunity to celebrate a family simcha. No matter the struggle, no matter how big of a schlep, I go. I go to a bris, I fly to a bar mitzvah, I fly to the wedding of grandchildren and of cousins, and I sing and I dance like I'm a teenager. You got to see me on the dance floor. Yeah, maybe I can't put the carry-on bag up there, but I sure can dance. Why do I do this? Because that's my response to Hitler, Yimach Shemai. Who danced last? And then the elderly survivor tells Rabbi Goldman, let me tell you a story. After the war was over and we were liberated, I didn't know what to do, where to go. So I decided I'm going back to my hometown of Vilna. First, I wanted to see if I could find any other surviving members of the family. And secondly, while in the camps, I would often dream of being back in Vilna, dream of being back in the great synagogue of Vilna where I used to pray with my family. And so I was driven by this desire, I have to get to Vilna. I have to get back home. It took a long time for me to get there. I wasn't the only one. There were hundreds of us battered and broken human beings trudging along the roads, asking, searching, hoping. And after weeks and weeks of travel, we came to Vilna. We walked the streets. You couldn't recognize the place. As was the case throughout Eastern Europe, by ridding Vilna of the Jews, the haters, whether it was the Nazis, the Russians, or the locals, they essentially drained the city of its life force. Its spirit was gone. Its dynamism was gone. The old neighborhood had become very dark, a dismal place. It was at this point that someone in the group brought to our attention that that night was going to be Shmini Atzeret and Simchas Torah, the holiday where we dance with the Torahs. Wow, were we excited. Let's get back to the great synagogue. We're going to celebrate Simchas Torah this year back in the great synagogue of Vilna. So we didn't just walk. As tired as we were, we ran. We ran towards the shul. It was all barricaded. There were boards all across. We didn't care. We tore the boards down, and we rushed into the synagogue. Upon entering, we couldn't believe the tragic sight that met our eyes. The ruin, the destruction, the desecration, torn prayer books all over the floor, bullet holes in the walls, bloodstains on all the benches. We cleaned up as best we could, and we decided that notwithstanding our sorrow and anguish, we will hold Simchas Torah celebration here. We walked to the eastern wall, to the magnificent Holy Ark. We opened the doors of the Ark, but empty. There were no Torahs to be found. We were beyond heartbroken, all of that enthusiasm that we're going to celebrate Simchas Torah, but we had no Torahs. But then I looked around the group. We were about 400 adults, many of them elderly. But there were also two children, 8 or 9 years old in the room. Children whose families had somehow survived the extermination of Vilna's Jewry. They had stayed in Vilna. And at that time, an idea came to mind. I started singing a song. We formed a circle. And we began to dance. We had no Torahs to carry in our arms, so you know what we did, Rabbi? We took those two beautiful children. We lifted them on our shoulders. And with tears in our eyes, we cried out, Ribbono shel Olam, Master in Heaven, we have no scrolls of ink and parchment, but these are our Sifrei Torah. These are our living Torahs. We danced and we danced from evening until morning with those smiling children. And the great synagogue of Vilna was suddenly filled once again with sanctity and with song. I cannot say if it was like the years before, but in many ways it was deeper, it was stronger, it was brighter than anything we ever experienced in our lives. Because in those moments of singing and dancing, in those moments of holding on to one another, of looking up at those children, we knew for a fact that in spite of all that we had just been through, Am Yisrael Chai, that the nation of Israel would live on. For as long as there are still children in the world to carry the torch of Torah forward, as long as there are children who would learn these lessons, these ideals, these truths, and teach them to their children, then the light of Israel shall shine on as a beacon of hope and goodness and decency for all of humanity, for all kind. That's the miracle of Jewish resiliency and Jewish continuity. That's the power and the impact of leaving a Jewish legacy, that we go on. The reason we're still here today is because we recognize that Judaism is not merely a religion or a lifestyle of the past. It is, in fact, the hope and the promise and the guarantee of a future, not only for the Jewish people, but I would say for all of humanity. We must be the selfless visionaries who build and secure it. And that's why creating this life list is such an important exercise. Hayom kotzer v'hamlocha meruba, time is short, but our task is great, say the sages. We are put on this earth to be God's partners, to fulfill a sacred mission. And if not us, then who? And if not now, then when? I want to conclude with a story that I read that I find quite moving. A few years ago, a beautiful young lady by the name of Christina Chesterman was killed by a drunk driver while riding her bicycle home after a day of study. Only 21 years old at the time, Christina was about to graduate from nursing school. A few weeks after her passing, her parents began the agonizing process of cleaning out their daughter's apartment. While doing this, Christina's mother, her name is Sandra, came across her daughter's makeup bag. And when she opened the bag, she discovered that there was no makeup inside. What was inside was a folded sheet of lined paper, and on the top of it, it said, Christina's bucket list. Her mother was stunned. What kid makes a bucket list? As a matter of fact, Christina had apparently begun to compile this list when she was 16 years old. Among the items on the list was that she wanted to tour Niagara Falls. She wanted to save someone's life in her lifetime. She wanted to find love, get married, and have a family. She wanted to go running through a field of poppies. She wanted to ride in a hot air balloon. All nice, sweet, and wholesome goals never to be realized, as a precious life was so abruptly and senselessly cut short. Suddenly, her parents knew what to do. They decided that they would now go forth and they would complete Christina's bucket list for her, at least the items that they could fulfill. And so they visited Niagara Falls and they went running through a field of poppies and they took a ride on a hot air balloon, whatever was on this list that they could do, all for Christina. And they continued to go ahead marking it off. But something else happened, something quite amazing. Her story started getting traction in social media. People heard about this. And the parents would post the pictures of them doing something on Christina's bucket list. And Christina's bucket list was then put on Facebook and on Instagram. And thousands of people, most of them total strangers, started taking on Christina's bucket list. And they would write to the Chesterman family all the updates. This is what we did today for Christina. This is what we did today for Christina. And our mother says, it inspires me so much that so many people out there remember my daughter by doing the things that she had on our list. I was moved by this story and the outpouring of love that came from all over the world to these grieving parents. The idea of completing one's life list for them, in fact, it's what is asked of each of us when we lose a loved one, is to complete their task. So if one lost a child or a brother or a sister or a mother or a father or a bubby or a Zaidi or a close friend, what is it that we want to do so much? We want them some way to live on. We want to find the things that they represented, their life list, and continue. Think about it. Is that not what the entire Torah is about? Can we look at the Torah as a breathing life list? Think of it this way. You read the story of our ancestors. They're not just stories. They're not just historical figures. They are mission statements being called upon us to make our own. So if you save a life, you're continuing the work of Noah, who saved humanity. If you help feed someone who's hungry and support someone who's weary, you're fulfilling Abraham and Sarah's life list. That's what they represented. When you study Torah, you are adopting Moses' life list. If you demonstrate pride and courage in your Jewish identity, you're fulfilling King David's life list. And so it is with all those who came before us, who had these meritorious life lists. They're waiting for us and they're depending on us to be inspired to the point that we lead and perpetuate their legacies forward. You see, once a soul passes to the next world, as we said earlier, it could no longer achieve further growth on its own. But there's one exception. There's one way we can do it, and only one way. That a departed soul could nevertheless achieve ascendery in the world of truth, could still feel as if they're accomplishing in the physical world, and that is if their memories and their legacies continue to inspire and motivate people in this world to perform mitzvot in their honor. That's how they live on. That's how they ascend in the heavenly world. So when you live in your life on a higher spiritual plane, you achieve immortality. Your parents and your grandparents live on in you. And you live on in your children and your grandchildren. They're part of your life, and you are part of theirs forever. So life is not a laundromat. Not at all. Let's draw up life lists. Let's set some real goals. Let's fill our lives with meaning, with beauty, with purpose, and with joy. One postscript. And it's a postscript to this talk and to all the talks that I gave. Of all the lists of goals ever compiled in the history of the Jewish people, I don't know if any were quite as bold, as extensive, as ambitious as the one set forth by the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He had such a list of goals and aspirations that he wanted to accomplish in his lifetime. They were bold. They were big. The Rebbe wanted to reach every single Jew on the face of the earth. And he got his shluchim and his shluchos and his emissaries and his chassidim and his followers and supporters all involved. Reach out and touch the lives of every single Jew on the face of the earth, not just those in Brooklyn, not just in New York, not just in the United States. Every Jew on the face of the earth. He dispatched emissaries and inspired the establishments of thousands of Chabad centers, and he launched mitzvah campaign after mitzvah campaign. What were these mitzvah campaigns? They were his goals and aspirations of how he was going to change the world, one mitzvah at a time, one Jew at a time. The Rebbe stayed in touch and on top of each of these campaigns and initiatives. He cared about our reports. We would write a report of what we did Hanukkah. How many people came to this particular mall? We would write up a report, send it to the Rebbe. We would get an answer back right away. The Rebbe read these reports. It was important to him. In everything the Rebbe did, in every teaching he shared, What always came across was the Rebbe's incredible Avos Yisrael. This was all because of his deep and genuine love and concern for the Jewish people. And in this aspect of the Rebbe, more than anything else, that's what enabled him to have the impact that he did and does on this world. And yet, there was one item, one major item, on the Rebbe's life list that he didn't get to check off in his physical lifetime. And in this monumental talk on the 28th day of the month of Nisan in the year 5751, corresponding to 1991, in this talk, and I quote in English what the Rebbe said to us in Yiddish, "I have done whatever I can to try to bring Mashiach. I am now giving this matter over to you. Please do what you can to make it a reality. Be stubborn and be persistent, but do not give up the quest. It's now up to us to check off the final item that has been on the list of this Jewish giant of history, that has been on the lists of the giants of history for the thousands of years of exile. This is our mandate. This is our mission. We can complete it, and we can't rest until we do. Thank you very much."
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.